gentlemen. Can we introduce Zoe Clark, resident political junkie at Michigan Radio?
Thanks, Rick Cluto, Lansing Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick and I, when we hold these issues in AL, when people are late, we do like to do this thing where then when they come and walk to the table, so when we see Stephen Henderson walk in, like, I'll make kind of a sign. What should the sign be?
No, we'll just announce him. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Henderson.
And then you all go, ooh, yeah, like that. We like to make the late ones feel
incredibly welcome. Do we need to practice?
Welcome. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Henderson. Love it. Love it.
Well done.
Yeah. And it has nothing to do with the endorsement, of course, which we will talk about once Stephen gets here.
Steve gets here.
Right, right. We only talk about people to their faces in politics. Yeah. So let's go through some housekeeping, shall we? Issues and Ale is an event series sponsored by Michigan Radio, designed to engage you, people, in conversations about important issues facing our state in a fun and informal atmosphere, which I believe we're all in this evening. Big, huge thanks to...
We'd like to thank the Detroit Beer Company for providing us with our venue.
And
by the way, Detroit Beer Company, I've been here before, and it's great to be back.
Trying to get some drinks out of that one. Not that journalists do that, ever, ever. I want to give a big shout-out to Cynthia Canty, the host of Stateside on Michigan Radio, who's here in the audience, right over here. A week from tonight, election night, Cindy is going to be hosting a special Issues and Ale election viewing party in Ann Arbor, 7:30. There'll be experts and pundits. It'll be a little bit of a similar atmosphere to this. I hope you can... Exactly, exactly. There are hourly shots, I think is what I heard. Right, so hang out there, watch elections. There'll be, like I said, special guests, and so that should be a lot of fun a week from tonight. Rick, do you want to introduce folks?
To my left. Well, just once more.
Hello, I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks so much for coming out tonight.
Stephen Henderson. Oh, wait.
Wah, wah, wah.
However, representing the Detroit Free Press, we have at the far right the amazing Nancy Kaffer.
It's on. Thank you. I'm just delighted to be here for the Rick and Zoe show.
Nancy's left, we have John...
Not politics or ideology.
Only spatially.
Right, right. Because no one else is till Nancy's left. We have John Bebo, who is the president and El Dictator Grande of the Center for Michigan.
Woo-hoo!
And also from the Center for Michigan and Bridge Magazine, we have the legendary David Zeman sitting to my right.
So we have an election coming up for those of you who have been living under a rock, or maybe not. I guess where I want to start is this really important debate, which we've been having over the past couple days now. Is this or is this not the most boring midterm election that Michigan has seen in, the past couple decades? Rick Pluta, do you want to take that question first?
No, I don't think it's the most boring. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's even that particularly boring. It's just... We've been talking about what we don't have. Just a moment.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Henderson. We set him up for it. Come on, grab a drink. Is it me? Okay. Grab a seat next to a...
Also,
that wasn't a boo, that was an ooh. Yeah.
That was an ooh. That was a like, ooh,
also,
ah. Also, Stephen, do you want to grab a seat right next to
and
Nan?
My God, someone get this man a drink.
Yes.
Please, put it on my tab.
Yeah. Okay, so what we are talking about while Stephen gets situated is the excitement or lack thereof of this election period. Rick Pluta, you are saying no, that you are super thrilled. You cover this every day. Of course, you are excited.
What's interesting about this is what's boring about it is that this is not an issues election. And I think what's
really... Explain what you mean by that.
I think what's frustrated political journalists is that we don't have that overarching issue, Obamacare, whatever, that everyone is talking about. But what we do have going on in this election in Michigan, a lot of other states, but especially Midwestern states, is this is a challenge for the Democratic coalition that they need to figure out if they're going to win elections that are going to determine things like redistricting, which have such profound implications, how to get their voters out during the midterm elections. It's a building period, right. And that's what this election is about. This is a test case for Lon Johnson, the chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party, who's standing in the back of the room.
I want to introduce my special guest tonight, Mr. Lon Johnson, who...
Yay. And I really was hoping to talk about political endorsements.
Yeah, right. I just had a very moving Mend the Fence beer over at the Anchor.
Interesting. Right? Well, maybe this election isn't as boring as I was just prefacing. Stephen Henderson, would you like to tell me about this off-the-record conversation that you and Lon Johnson just had over beverages?
By definition, off-the-record means none of your business, right?
Look, I'm going to shorthand it for you, Zoe. They wept softly. They drank beer.
Everyone's friends. We drank whiskey. Yeah. We drank beer.
Yeah. Well, so now that we have the two gentlemen in the room that I would love to hear from about the endorsement, Stephen, I guess my question reading the endorsement that you have, how much was this an endorsement for Snyder or an endorsement because you weren't moved by Mark Schauer as a candidate?
Well, I mean, I think if you read our editorial page consistently, we have very deep and at times very bitter disagreements with the governor about any number of different things. I mean, I could go back to right to work or some of the abortion legislation he signed, campaign finance. Did I miss anything?
Schools.
And we entered this election cycle ready to do something else. And I made that clear in a column I wrote on January 1st of this year, pretty much sort of, I have a good friend who has described that as the breakup column, right? And there's some song that says, "We are never, ever getting back together," right? I think of that when I read the column. I mean, we have been done with this governor for some time. At the same time, endorsements are not just about one candidate. They are comparative analyses. And I have always set the bar at the same height for everybody. And so for a Democrat, I needed a lot more than I feel like I've gotten from Mark Schauer about what he will do differently. And I like specifics. I like deep policy discussions. We had, when the governor came in for his endorsement interview, we had one of the best policy discussions I've had with him, even though we disagreed on lots of things. When Mark came in, and this was the day after the town hall, where I thought his performance was also wanting, we didn't have that kind of discussion. We didn't get to the things, to the kind of understanding I like to have with candidates before I endorse them. And so it was a very close call. There were lots of people on the board who would have done something different.
Stephen, can I ask a question?
Can I say just really quickly?
Yeah.
There's a lot of the times, I'd say 75% of the time, we walk into the room after an interview and we all know what we want to do, and there's like, we all say, this is the thing, yes, this is the thing, and we move forward. This was, when we wrote in the editorial, this was not an easy decision. This was not an easy decision. We screamed at each other for like a month. No, I mean, we talked heatedly for a month.
Is this the first time you two have sat next to each other since the decision was made?
We're still not speaking. No. This was a very long debate. This was not an easy call.
I always say that at the newspaper in general, this is a sort of analogy that I got from an old editor that I used to work for, He said, you know, sometimes we get through the night and get the thing out the door and it's fine. Other times we get it out and there's blood on the table. This was a blood on the table kind of time, and you got to have those. I think you got to be able to disagree and come out on the other end with a decision that everybody can at least live with. And I think that's probably the best description.
I have a question for you, though, on that. You told me that this was a roughly 2,000-word essay.
That, I think it was more than that, but 2,000 sounds good, right?
Okay. It's still a lot of words.
Yeah, a lot of words.
A lot of words. I'm sure you read all of them.
Every one. No, some of them twice. But you said that there were things that you really, really hoped that the governor would shift on in a second administration. Some of them, you know, profound, you know, big. Do you have any reason whatsoever to believe that
he or
the administration will heed those words?
So, I'm trying to think of how much I'm comfortable saying. I mean, so over the last 4 years, I have gotten to know the governor pretty well. I mean, he was somebody I didn't know really at all before 2009, when he first started saying he wanted to run for governor. And I feel like over the last 5 years, we've actually had a fair number of conversations. I think I know a lot about what he actually believes versus what he has to do and things like that. I think this will be this is just a bold prediction that could be absolutely wrong. I don't know. I think this would be a very different 4 years over the next 4 years than it was the first 4 years. I think he has learned a lot about politics and the process, and there are things he believes that he has not been able, not felt like he was able to do. And now, is he going to do those things?
I want to jump into what we're sort of expecting in the next 4 years, but I want to make sure, John Bebo, it looked like you were kind of at the edge of your seat wanting to say something when we were asking Stephen about the endorsement. Please jump in.
Zoe, always when you're talking, I'm at the edge of my seat.
That was a bunch of swearing that just got beeped out.
I cannot believe you just said that to me, John Bebo.
Shocking.
The question was, is this a boring election? I think sometimes we can get boring. So I hope we get to hear from you tonight. I hope there's some interaction. I hope you have some great questions for us. Not you, Nancy, not you.
On any topic but the endorsement.
Yeah. Nancy Derringer from Bridge Magazine in the back. No, but I think there's some drama in this election, and it has to do with the man in the blue suit who just walked in, Lon Johnson, who you may not know is a fabulous trout angler in northern Michigan. Has a place up there that he probably hasn't seen in at least 18 months. But I think this election is partly about Lon, in all seriousness, because the Democratic Party in Michigan is on a huge losing streak. There has been one Democrat elected on the statewide ballot for statewide office in Michigan in the last 20 years. Her name is Jennifer Granholm. She won election several times. No other Democrat on the statewide ticket has won since Frank Kelly and Richard Austin.
Well, here's
I'm talking about the three statewide offices. Attorney General, they're Secretary of State, and the governor, the big three races that we run.
Nick, do you need the microphone?
I think Lon is a fascinating guy, and he's had a plan this year to really look at data and to drive turnout, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see if Lon can work his magic and turn things around for the Democratic Party. I think that's one of the most interesting points.
Radio producer, I like to do this thing called an arc, which is that we start at this really beautiful beginning of our conversation, and then the middle kind of peaks, and the end is a big picture. And we've just sort of thrown out about 1,000 things, all of which I want to get to. And one of the big things was the endorsement. And like John said, I want to make sure that anyone who has any questions about the endorsement feels free to ask them. The next thing I want to talk about
is... Or we have a ring set up downstairs, and if you want to go, like, 5 rounds with me over...
Yeah, yeah. I think Stephen's ready for that one. Or if you just want to buy him a beverage, too.
Republicans were not thrilled with that endorsement.
They shouldn't have been.
Look, the ultimate, at the end of the day, if you're a journalist, you should have, quite frankly, pissed everyone off, right? And I think we high five. We did it.
Including each other.
You know, anyone who interpreted it as a
if that were a marriage proposal, the answer should be no.
Well, and I say this all the time. endorsements are not marriage proposals. I'm not saying I'm in love with anybody. What I'm saying is I've got a choice to make that I didn't frame, right? I don't choose the candidates. I don't get to decide who's on the ballot. I have to decide between the people who are, and it's often a very filthy, undesirable choice. This was one of those times, and I got to make the call that I can sleep with at night, and that's you know the best I can do.
Was there ever a choice that any of you had to think that maybe you didn't want to make an endorsement in this race? Was that something that came up?
We believe pretty strongly. Steve actually.
So voters don't have that choice, right? If you want to count.
Yes.
No, they don't.
We tell voters repeatedly, go out and vote. It's really important to vote. It's the exercise of your principal right as an American, and we feel very strongly. Steve,
I feel very strongly about newspapers that do the non-endorsement endorsement. I think that's the most cowardly thing you can ever do as an institution. Voters don't have that choice.
The Toledo War begins again.
If we fail to endorse, then we sacrifice all credibility in telling voters that they must vote. We can't say we're going to exercise an option we don't think that you should have.
Yes.
And we think that you all should vote, and so we had to make a selection as well.
Cindy was going to ask a question. I guess that was the same one, was about the non-endorsement. Okay, so I want to shift a little bit, but if there are endorsement questions from anyone in the audience, please, it sounds like what we're doing is just sort of throwing them out. Go ahead.
I have a question about the endorsements that were by the Free Press a week or two ago. With the exception of one Republican, all of the other endorsements were, and there were several, that were Democrats.
Yeah, they were.
How do you expect, if those people that you endorsed would win, how do you expect them to work with Snyder?
So, personally,
there'd be another standstill.
Can I take this one?
Please, Nancy.
I personally think government works best when it's not completely controlled by one party. I think we have to have incentive for deal-making. I think if we were, by some amazing stroke of electoral miraculousness, to get a Democratic-controlled legislature with a Republican governor, I think we could maybe see some stuff for Michigan that is really good and maybe where we all kind of want to go. I think that, you run into trouble. I also think that you run into trouble when one party kind of stagnates because it doesn't get enough play in state politics. I think it would be amazing if that happened. I think there would be a good back and forth. I think there might be, like I said, politics is about the art of the deal. And if there's no incentive to make a deal, we all kind of...
So I'll tell you a little background story that I know. In 2012, so 2 years after the governor won, he was not on the ballot. But, of course, the House was up. The state House was up.
And a presidential year, which changes the dynamics for voters here in Michigan.
I have a friend who was in the room with the governor's staff when it was clear that the Democrats were not going to be close to taking the House back. The Democrats made some really bad choices late in that campaign, in my opinion, about where they spent money, trying to take out Jace Bulger instead of a couple of other districts where they were close. There was a palpable sigh of disappointment in the room. Why? Because the greatest strength Rick Snyder was ever going to have as governor was at least one chamber of Democrats. Not because he's particularly liberal, but because he could leverage that against the more extreme elements of his own party. This idea that one of the problems with politics right now is that everybody gets caricatured to a ridiculous extreme. I mean, I hear people say things about Rick Snyder that I know are not true about what he thinks, about how he feels, about what he's going to do. I hear people say the same things about Jennifer Granholm or John Dingell or any of these people. And so, I always try to urge people to resist that. They are not cartoons. These are very complex people with very complex thoughts.
Personally, when reading any analysis, I am very, very wary of any writer or speaker or whatever who tries to project motives onto people who they have no personal knowledge of or conversation with. So I think that that kind of holds true to this caricature thing. If you hear someone expounding on what so-and-so, who doesn't have the benefit of personal conversation or personal interaction with them, it's like, what, you're just making stuff up? What?
I want to turn to John and David and get your perspective. You both have done some actual work. I guess, John, you more in terms of actually lobbying the administration for some things that I think you could sort of call centrist, right? $65 million a year going to early education here in the state, something that both it seemed like Democrats and Republicans could sort of get behind. What is your sense then in the next 4 years after lobbying and trying to actually create some bipartisanship, if we have another 4 years of Governor Snyder, if most likely the House stays under Republican control, the Senate certainly will. What are your hopes as sort of a bipartisan think tank to actually see some of what Nancy and Stephen are talking about, which is a sort of wonderful idea that we might actually not see gridlock and see some parties working together?
Lobbying is a big word. I'm not sure I would use that for our work. Zoe's talking about the early childhood, where Bridge Magazine and the center did some policy work that laid out some options for how the state could improve early childhood investment. And I end up now spending a lot of time at national early childhood conferences talking about how Republicans passed this, which they did. It's really an issue that defies partisanship, certainly in this state, and depending on who you talk to in the legislature, there are Tea Party people who said, this is small government, that's why I'm voting for it, because it saves money down the road. And there are Democrats who have always supported early childhood. But in terms of the next 4 years, I think it's going to be very interesting to if Snyder wins, whether it's really 4 years or not. There's a presidential election coming up in 2 years, and there's lots of buzz in Lansing about ambition, and I don't think it has to do with the White House, but there's talk about ambition of seeking something at the federal level, and I wonder if that something isn't U.S. budget director, through which you have to play games to get there and run for vice president or something. But I there's going to be a lot of turnover in the governor's administration. There already is. He's lost Bill Rustem, who was a lion of Michigan policy issues and got along with everybody on the left and the right and is a genuine great human being. And I think there are other senior advisors who it's going to be really hard to see if they stick around. I don't think all of them will. So I think there's going to be leadership questions if Snyder does get reelected. Unlike someone who's there and is going to serve two full terms and they get some momentum in the second term, I think there are going to be some questions about where Rick Snyder's headed. I think he's got to deliver on roads. He's staked a lot on that, and he hasn't delivered on that. The people want it. You can look at any poll, any of the public engagement work the center does. They want that. He hasn't been able to get that. I think his first chance to get that was to do some trading in the whole right to work debate. He got nothing in return for giving up right to work, and I think he missed some opportunities there. So I think there's a lot of questions and a lot of murkiness about where a Snyder administration is headed next.
And remember that lame duck terms are never kind.
Well, so I want to get to lame duck a little bit, but I think as we talked a little bit about, I want to get back
to... talking about a four-year lame duck term, not the lame duck session.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about this idea about getting out the vote, because I think that's one of the biggest things that we know that Democrats absolutely have to do in midterm elections. There are more registered...
That's the story of this election.
Okay.
It's so, GOTV.
So, Rick, fill us in a little bit about some of the Democratic efforts, about what's trying to go, happen. We are seeing President Obama here on Saturday, most political pundits saying he's toxic, and yet we are seeing him and a lot of, at least the statewide candidates, open arms, welcoming him here.
Well, I guess there are two separate things in that, and one of them is that Barack Obama is coming to Michigan because Democrats are not going to win in Michigan by persuading independents. It may be an element of what they're trying to do, and ask that guy about that, but What they've got to do is they've got to get their voters out, that they've got to secure their base, and they've got to get their voters out. And if they don't do that, then nothing else matters. And who better to bring out Barack Obama voters who voted in the last presidential election than Barack Obama? It's why he's coming. It makes perfect sense that his job is not to persuade anyone, although he will try. His job is to persuade Democrats to either get out on Election Day or before Election Day vote absentee. And absentee voting is huge. And I don't want to feed your ego. I mean, I really, really, really don't want to feed your
ego. But your hair looks great tonight, Lon.
So great.
But I was talking to a candidate, a Republican candidate this morning, who said that his biggest concern wasn't his Democratic opponent on the ballot.
It wasn't the money that they were spending against him. It was.
His biggest concern was, he said, you know, my opponent isn't that guy. My opponent is Lon Johnson. And he was talking about the Democrats' get-out-the-vote efforts and the fact that everything is going to rely. I mean, this whole thing turns on whether Democrats get their voters out. And it was a really, really interesting conversation. He was talking about how he felt so helpless because he is basically, his future hinges on GOTV, Republican and Democratic, and how well the top of the ticket does. And you've got a Senate a candidate on the Republican side who seems to be heading south quickly, and you've got a Republican candidate for governor who the numbers seem to be breaking his way right now, but you know, he ain't exactly setting the world, you know, the state on fire either.
And this is something that you and I have talked about, this idea that, you know, Snyder likes to say that he is not a politician, and he can say that. I mean, the fact is he's the governor,
he is, of course, a
politician. But this idea that he has he done enough, and I want to hear everyone's...
And by the way, he doesn't say that he's not a politician. He says he's a unique politician.
Okay. But what I want to hear is all the panelists' sort of idea, and this is that he may feel that way, but doesn't he have some sort of ownership? Doesn't he need to take something, some ownership of how well Republicans do? And that number is 55% is what political pundits will say he needs to win. It's what we've said in order to be able to help some of these lower races. Nan, yeah.
Ooh, I have something.
Nancy, go ahead.
I don't think not being a politician is actually a qualification when you're running for a political office. And I think that throughout his term, though he's had people around him, Bill Rustin, for example, Dennis Muchmore, who are very adept politicians, I think that some of the biggest deficiencies we've seen in his process has been because he is not a politician.
But isn't that why folks voted for him in 2010? Because they felt like, here's
you
this
folks?
Guy. I think maybe
he
Democrats.
Won because
not
Democrats
the only reason
didn't
it's it, for voters, it is a comparative analysis too. And again, I don't know. Let's go back 4 years. Let's think about Verge Bernero and the kind of candidate.
Oh, do we have to?
I mean, that's what voters are faced with. It's not about this person in absolute. It's about this person versus that person. And, 4 years ago, most Dems I know did not vote for Verge Bernero.
Very true.
Most
true.
Dems. I was going to say that when we see a strong political leader in the governor's seat, we see someone who has control of the state's party. We see better candidates making it to the ballot. We see, you know, an effective politician, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, in a high-ranking seat can have a lot more control over what's happening all over the ballot. And, yeah, if things don't go well, then... Sure, he's got to take some of that. Is that the question you're asking? If you're
I think the question is the governor, as apparently the leader of the Republican Party, and maybe Bobby Shostak,
does he have a responsibility to help bring other Republicans across the goal?
Who are you thinking of, though? Okay, so let's go down the ticket. Terry Lynn Land, he's not going to help her out. She's not helping herself.
She's not going to help herself.
She's not helping herself.
But that also makes part of the case, which is that Republicans are saying Terry Land is not going to do it.
But could he have helped if he were more of a politician in shaping the ticket so that there was a Senate candidate?
There's internal data circulating in Republican circles that when a Republican gubernatorial candidate wins with 55% or more of
the vote, 75%
of the time, they take their Senate candidate across the goal line.
And that's,
What they're looking at, except that they're not just looking at it in terms of their Senate candidate. They've given up on Terry Land. I mean,
well, but
if she wins, keep going down the congressional candidates.
Bill Schuette does not need Rick Snyder's help. Bill Schuette is a more, in my estimation, a more credible Republican candidate, familiar face with his own base.
Politician.
He doesn't need Rick Snyder to help him out. Who's next? Ruth Johnson.
State Board of Education, which will be hiring a superintendent. Regents of the public universities, at least
that's
the big
three.
That's
where you would see, and that's where all you would see
the,
a real difference.
And all of the local races, congressional and legislative, where GOTV is going to make a difference, that it's not going to be just the candidate.
But you don't have that many congressional races that are in play. I mean, we said so in our endorsement. If you look at the way the map has been drawn, there's not really an opportunity for competitive races in, I don't know, 9 or 10 of the congressional districts. So it's not the same kind of thing, and he is not the same kind of politician that, say, a Jennifer Granholm might have tried to be, or certainly a John Engler, who was all about that.
But no one argues with the success of John Engler.
No, that's my point. I mean, John Engler,
who was a
was
partisan,
unabashed about that partisanship and about the fact that he was in charge, right? Not just in charge in the legislature, but in charge of
John
the
is
election.
At the edge of his seat again.
So I noticed David's been quite quiet.
I was just looking for another beer.
can somebody please get David Zeman a beer?
David, what are you drinking?
I know, David Zeman has been the quietest I have ever seen him anywhere.
He's waiting for a beer.
Oh, I'm good.
IPA.
What John says is about to say.
Well, you talked a little bit about Obama, and I don't know. Why is Obama coming to Michigan? He's in his second term. He's got 2 years to go. What does Obama need right now? He needs the Senate. He's here for Gary Peters. So you're not going to convince me that he's here to elect a Democratic governor of Michigan. I'm sorry. I don't believe it. There's nothing in it for Obama to elect a Democrat to be governor of the state. He's here to secure the Senate seat because he needs the Senate.
Well, especially this governor who's actually played a lot of footsie with the Obama administration.
Yeah, they have. But yeah. So let's talk a little bit about why Obama's here. But secondly, and Lon Johnson's the gift that keeps on giving tonight. Thanks for bringing him, Steve. You know, if Lon and Mark Schauer pull this off, it will be an amazing, amazing win for Mark Schauer. This campaign reminds me...
The first time since the 1960s that a governor running for a second term would have been defeated.
Here's what amazes me. Here's what will really amaze me if this happens. This race reminds me so much of 1994. We had a West Michigan congressman who ran against an incumbent Republican governor in an improving economy... And John Engler beat Howard Wolpe with 61% of the vote.
Well, and by the way, the Free Press endorsed Engler.
Did they? Well, how
shocking. And that wasn't me, folks.
Here's why I think part of that matters. Howard Wolpe probably did more for African Americans and black people around the world than any congressman Michigan's ever had. He fought apartheid from Kalamazoo in his district and was heroic in doing so. He couldn't turn out the vote in southeastern Michigan. So if Lon manages to do it with Mark Schauer, it will be a hell of a win. And I hope we in the media recognize it if it happens, because
feel like we're all articulating the things that keep Lon up at night.
That's right.
Why don't we just have him talk about what he's doing?
Well, if he wants to come up and talk, he can. I don't think he does. But...
The crowd wants you, Lon.
But I think one of the things that's really important about what's changed since 1994 and now is the way people vote, the way people interact with each other and with political parties. And I, without betraying any...
Howard Wolpe also overestimated his crossover appeal.
He totally overestimated a lot of things. But I think the party deserves a lot of credit this cycle, no matter what happens, for trying some things that have not been tried before, and really trying to identify people who don't vote regularly, who are Democrats, and trying to get them to vote. And I think there could be some surprises as we get to election night about how that happened and what the effect is on the overall.
And I don't want to keep harping on Mark Schauer, and maybe it sounds like that, but do you think a combination of Alon Johnson, this is so weird to talk about you as if you're like not here, Alon Johnson and a stronger candidate, one like a Jennifer Granholm, who had that charisma and the energy and that voters seem to really have passion for, if we saw that kind of...
But who also, when she ran for her first term, quite bluntly, lacked the sort of substantial, you know, how am I going to get it done agenda that the Free Press editorial page complained about in their endorsement.
There again, who was her competitor?
I just wonder if Mike Duggan wants Schauer to win.
We're going to endorse Dick Posthumus. Come on. Again, it's a comparative analysis. Jennifer Granholm versus Posthumus was a no-brainer.
I just heard a Monsieur Duggan reference.
I just wonder if Mike Duggan really wants Schauer to win.
Well, let's dig a little deeper in that. It does seem that the mayor of Detroit
has, according to Michigan Campaign Finance Network, he's now the third largest PAC in Michigan, and I don't think that's just for the city of Detroit.
Though, if you look at the most recent filings, they spent all of that money on the mayoral election. He's not sitting on a big war chest.
But it shows a prowess to raise.
It absolutely does. You know, obviously everyone is filled with speculation about whether or not Mike Duggan would like to be governor. And once again, I caution people to be wary of anyone who suggests they know what a person is thinking, but they don't have any intimate knowledge of that person's thoughts. Let's say when you look at Mike Duggan's track record.
And having a substantial political action committee.
But yet,
can be
I'm going
used
to go
for,
do it anyway.
Well, no. I'm backing up Nancy on this. That having a substantial political action committee could exist for a wide variety of purposes.
I will also say, when you look at Mike Duggan's career, we've seen him take on organization after organization that is super screwed up. And you might ask yourself, would Mike Duggan have run for governor in 2010? Yeah, I could totally see that. But in, when I don't know if Michigan's going to be screwed up enough.
A week before midterm, we are all putting money on a Schuette versus Duggan race. Is that what you're hearing in 2018?
That'd
be really interesting.
I'm not.
So I would like to point out one thing, going back to the beginning of the conversation,
please.
When you guys said this was a very boring midterm election. When there's a combative and expensive primary, we bemoan all of the money that goes into a primary election and all the way that candidates tear each other apart before we even get to the general, and they do all the work of the opposing party by fighting with each other. And in this particular election, we saw the parties select their candidates early and often. We saw them line up support behind specific candidates for the governor's seat and for the Senate seats, and we saw all of the party's resources come to bear on electing those people, and now we're still not satisfied. we say it's boring. So I mean,
well, did you see the Onion article? The Onion
reporters
article
are awful
that said
people?
That,
what?
That people line up to elect the leaders that they're going to blame in the next election cycle
for
putting America.
I would argue this is one of the things we actually want parties to do more of, which is to focus support behind specific candidates and time for the funds and the efforts to put in to theoretically move the needle. This is one of the things we would probably like to see them do more often as opposed to costly and divisive primary fights. Yeah, your mileage may vary, but...
But don't we also... I mean, we worship at the altar of bipartisanship. And at the same time, we expect our politicians and our political parties to stand for things. And those don't neatly fit together.
I think they do. I think a lot of policy
is
absent of... I think a lot of good policy can be absent of partisanship. I think that's what's wrong with the system, is too much of it is not.
What
we need in Michigan is decisions that are absent straight party line politics. The system is broken, and it's not going to get fixed. Neither party can win.
The culture reaches consensus on questions like early childhood learning after years and sometimes generations of partisan bickering before they reach a conclusion. But it's partisanship that leads to that.
I want to make sure that anyone who's got questions in the audience is willing to jump in, because we could continue to do this until February, and we probably will.
Oh, and we will.
On.
We like to hear ourselves talk.
Right, and that's very evident. So I want to make sure that if you've got questions for any of the panelists...
jump up, wait for a microphone, please.
Yeah. Are there any questions so far? Really? Oh, come on.
Have you... Come on. You've been drinking out there. For crying out loud.
I know what my email and my voicemail and my Twitter account have looked like for the last 2 days.
Stephen does not
There's
believe...
no way people don't have anything to say to me.
So we've touched on the outside of the Senate race, but I think let's talk a little bit about Terry Lynn Land as a candidate. Rick, you were the first one actually to have an hour-long sit-down with her. I'll just put it out here that we weren't... Spoopy. Well, they like you. They really like you.
Bootlicker. Why did she come see you?
Well,
I've heard it's
I had a
Mad
really good
type environment
down
at Michigan Radio. I don't know.
So I'll totally put this out here, and I was telling Matt this on the way in that, I was the executive producer of the show, and we were not sure until the morning of whether Terry would actually make it or not. It was... I was calling her campaign people the night before and texting them and didn't hear anything, and it wasn't until they retweeted a tweet about an hour before the show that... we were certain she was going to be here, and Rick, that hour-long got a lot of coverage, not only because you did such a fabulous job, but also because it was the first hour-long conversation that we had with Terry, and that was on October 3rd. That was the first time that
Well, keep in mind, too, that an hour-long broadcast conversation with any candidate
Rick,
is,
7 minutes
is a rarity.
Rick, 7 minutes would have been a big deal on October 3rd with her. Oh. So what does it say about a candidate now, a week before an election, how she's doing? Was this more about Terry Lynn Land as a candidate? Was this a complete, absolute disaster for her campaign? Let's just dig into them a week before the campaign.
Rick, take a minute and think, because I have a newsflash. This is for Kathy Gray's benefit from the Free Press. Chad Livengood is over there talking up Lon Johnson. I wanted you to know. Chad Livengood from the Detroit News is over there getting an exclusive, and Kathy's over here, and I don't think that's
fair. He's over there being you.
Okay.
Watch it, Livengood.
All right, that's called fair play right there.
Are you guys in the same building now? Are you supposed to?
What helped me is out. Look at that.
As you were.
I just wanted to talk about Terry Lynn Land for the next few minutes. That's
I guess my takeaway from that is, and the good news for everyone sitting up here is that we in the news media still matter. That you cannot run a big statewide race and expect to do it entirely with social media, friendly events and a big advertising campaign. Is that you do have to go and submit to the media filter, no matter how much you may dislike it, and no matter how sloppy it and we may be at times in terms of doing it. You cannot disappear and not talk to journalists through the entire course of a campaign. One of the things that a lot of people talked about when they covered it and was how they would say, well, look, we're doing lots and lots of public events, but these public events were never publicized so that people like reporters could attend them until after they were over. And so I am pleased to report that apparently, based on that singular experience, the news media still matters.
I don't know how much the news media still matters. Does anyone in the state know anything about the Supreme Court justices other than...
You are so harsh in my mellow, dude.
other than that the two Republicans really, really don't like child molesters?
Or terrorists.
If you would all read the Free Press's thorough and thoughtful endorsements of the Supreme Court justices, you could know all about that.
Save us from ourselves.
It matters only as long as you follow up. You have call-in people on the radio show, and they ask questions, and you have politicians that skirt and say all kinds of taglines, and they don't answer the question until they're forced to answer the question with a follow-up. They're still playing.
Beeps.
I applaud you, sir, and I'd like to take that in a direction, if you'll let me. I think we'd matter more if we worked together, and here's how. I really applaud Stephen for trying to get a debate commission going in the state. He's worked hard.
We're going to get there. 2018, we will have that.
But here's the thing. I think he's wrong.
Oh.
I think the best model for getting gubernatorial candidates to talk and to talk in unscripted ways is through Pluto's radio shows. They call in. They're on there for an hour. They don't know what the next call is going to be. I've heard Rick Snyder get caught in something and have to apologize in one of his interviews, which I don't think was in the script. And I think that's awesome. I think what we need is not debates. I was one of
but
the...
But why does it have to be either or? Yeah. Why can't we have a series of debates that includes
let me get there.
That and...
Let me get there. I
like what he's saying.
I helped produce the debate in 2010. It was the only debate we had. And two nights before it, was I negotiating questions?
No.
Was I
negotiating
length
process.
Of answers?
Podium height.
I was negotiating podium height. The length of the how high the microphones were. Here's what I think we need to do to work together. I think if we got together in campaign years and we laid out an agenda of asking really tough, in-depth questions in our various platforms, and we agreed to publish them in a single place where voters on the night before the election, because let's face it, that's when most voters really give a shit, is the night before the election. We gave them everything we have on our terms, in-depth answers to in-depth questions that we follow for half a year. I think that matters so much more than trying to get a one-upsmanship going in debates, which I think never works.
I
want to tell a funny story, because I don't think this has been funny enough. About the 2010
those
debate.
Those socks are funny.
There's nothing... Don't laugh at the socks. They're always stripes or polka dots. Everyone knows that.
Hashtag Steve Socks.
Funny story. 2010, we did get that debate between Rick Snyder and Virge Bonaro, and it was the only debate, and DPTV, who was producing it, was really just, you know, undone at the idea that we landed the only gubernatorial debate. So we just knocked it out of the park with bells and whistles, and there was like caviar being served in the press room, and that's not true, but
catered by Aramark.
But they
that wasn't caviar.
No, you and Nolan shared a can of hairspray, and there was plenty left over.
That's right. So, but they wanted to make the studio really cool, and we were sort of new in that space, and they painted the floor brand new that night for the debate. And so they hadn't thought about what kind of paint to use, and it hadn't dried. So the candidates came in, and like 10 minutes into practice, they both were like, I can't move my legs. Or if they did move their feet, it made this really loud cracking noise. So the both of them had to stand there for this hour and a half not moving their legs, which meant their legs fell asleep. And both of them were sort of at the end, sort of like, well, you know. I mean, they were both really uncomfortable.
Did their shoes,
time.
Like, pull up paint at the end of
there was paint on the bottom
and
of
so
both of their
so
shoes.
And
so
it's so hard for me to believe why candidates wouldn't want to debate
studio.
This year.
So I have to say, first of all, anyone
I wasn't finished with my story.
Oh, go, Jesus, go.
But the idea behind the debate, in my estimation, is... It is a performance in some ways, but that's an important performance. Being able to answer deeply sort of research policy questions on the fly. Nolan and I spend hours. Nolan and I spent more time together this October than you can imagine preparing for that debate. You know, you do get an idea of how they respond in that forum, and I don't think that's unimportant. My idea is... We have a debate commission that schedules three or four of those every cycle, and they are different formats. One's a debate, one's a call-in with Rick Bluta, one's a town hall. We can do all of that stuff. The point being, if we all work together to do it, they would have no choice. The candidates would not be able to say...
It has to be a command performance.
And Rick and I have talked about this before, that the media is just almost as much at fault about this because we don't have that, and that there are certain players within the system...
No, I disagree. Not just almost.
Okay.
Michigan news media has basically ceded control of this conversation to candidates.
To the candidates.
We allow them to negotiate the conditions with each other.
And what I'm trying
to do is they play us off together. Each other. They play us off each other.
It's because we're stuck on a format. You're stuck on a format. Yeah. That you're not thinking about the customer. The customer is the voter. The voter needs solid information before they go to the polls. There are many other ways beyond debates to do that. Steve just talked about candidates need to be able to answer on the fly. Policy, good or bad, is very rarely made on the fly. And I think what we need is a concerted effort to go deeper and get solid answers that in one place, whether you go to the Free Press or Michigan Radio or Rick's Show or Bridge Magazine, that night before the election when, I'm sorry, it's when many people are first really getting into this, that's where they get solid answers to the in-depth questions, and that's where we really can set the tone. We'll never set the tone in debates. It's impossible. We need to go where we actually have leverage and use the tools at our availability to serve the customer who is the voter.
Please, the crowd.
It's on now? Great. All right. For one thing, I have two things, I guess, really quickly. That's already there. If you go to the News and Free Press the day before or the day of the election, they have a list of candidates. They have questionnaires that have been submitted to those candidates with extensive answers that those candidates have had a chance to prepare. That's how you can get information about candidates the day of or the day before an election. And if a candidate hasn't taken the time to answer a question, then that also tells you a lot about that candidate. So what you're talking about as a solution to this problem already exists, but also the problem still exists, so it must not be working. Secondly, going back to the endorsement.
Careful, I'm one of your customers.
I'm not actually, well, that's a whole different discussion.
That is a whole different discussion.
Steven, it's the other way around, buddy.
I might have been overserved the night before the endorsement.
I saw your tab. You totally were.
That's the headline out of tonight. Henderson drunk during endorsement.
I might have been overserved.
Von der Darien, owner of the fabulous Anchor Bar, ladies and gentlemen.
So...
Who invented the phrase, I believe, bourbon and bullshit on
that was that's an awesome event. Yeah. That's coming soon.
And the after party's at your place tonight, right?
Sure. So my question going back to the endorsement, and not really an accusatory question, but as a Democratic voter, my mind's been made up for the past, 2 years, give or take, as soon as the right to work was passed in the lame duck session. For me, that was a point of no return. There's nothing that could ever make me vote for Rick Snyder at this point. And what I want to ask is, as an institution, when you're doing your endorsement, do you feel that the institution should have that same sense of memory? Because, as you were saying, what you're trying to do is answer the question as a voter, to say, if the Free Press had to vote, this is what we would do based on the candidates in front of us. So, given that, do you think that those questions, those historical acts, should weigh larger than they seem to in your editorial article?
It's not that they don't weigh large. They do. And we spent a lot of time in the endorsement addressing not just right to work, but abortion and schools and all these other things. I try to sort of think of this as the way I spent a long time in Washington covering the Supreme Court. Developed a real respect for the idea of weighing lots of different things and lots of different factors before you make a decision by covering the justices. It's not that right to work doesn't matter. It does. It matters intensely to me. It's not that abortion doesn't matter. It matters intensely to me. It's not that gay rights don't matter. It's that they fit into a much larger context of factors that I'm looking at when I'm looking at candidates. And one of them is the ability to govern, the ability to say, I don't just believe this, but here's how I get from here to there. And that was what I was looking for from Mark. And I was very upfront with the shower campaign since this summer about my need to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And in the overall weighing sort of analysis, the weighing exercise I went through, the anger that I have over those issues did not pull the scale sufficiently to Mark's side. Mark didn't put enough on his side of the scale.
So I want to also say that in terms of the endorsement, there are six, it was, what are we calling it, a 2,000-word essay. There were six pieces where we looked at specific areas.
Jewel edited them. She's going 4,000, Nan.
4,000-word pieces. There was no intention on our part to disregard any of the profound differences we've had with Governor Snyder. In fact, we felt kind of a moral imperative to address those issues. We didn't feel that we could simply disregard those or wink at them or not really treat them. So that's why we wrote this very long, incredibly large amount of words.
Can I interrupt you? We just had a George Bush moment. Stephen checked his watch.
Oh, Stephen, come on. I
have to
away.
Get home to my kids. Oh. Sorry.
Stephen, real quick, what's the price of milk?
I know the price of gas. I don't know the price of milk.
So
I'm embarrassed to be up here. I quit.
Those fancy scanners in the grocery store, what's that about?
So what I was going to say, if you want to read these six pieces and you come out with a conclusion that supports your belief that you've had for 2 years, that's your lookout. I mean, that's, you know, you're welcome to take that conclusion away.
Yeah.
Question back there.
Stephen, on the endorsement, how do you think...
I think we're done here.
Yeah. Will you feel responsible for decreased get out the vote or making Lon Johnson's job harder after this is all over? And did
because
you consider the whole?
Were you eavesdropping?
Did you consider the whole ticket? You know, Brian Kelly, Lisa Brown. Were they considered at all in the endorsement process?
Well, that's an interesting question. We did not look.
Great question.
We did not look all that closely at that question because I mean it's not like vice president. Lieutenant Governor is somewhat a less important office. It's an interesting question about the turnout. I wasn't thinking that we would suppress turnout by endorsing.
Enthusiasm.
Well, are you enthusiastic about Mark Schauer? Yeah, well, all right. Well, that's my point. I mean...
Right. And this is what I was trying to get at initially with the endorsement question, that is this more about the candidate of Mark Schauer than the things that Snyder has done?
This was definitely more about Schauer's inability to clear a burden that I... a minimum burden that I set for candidates than it was about the governor, who everyone knows what we think of him.
You got another question. Yeah.
So I'm sorry to perseverate about the endorsement, but I wanted to follow up on things that you both just said. I did read all 4,000 words, and I did see that there were six areas of issues. Yeah, thank you. I did see that there were six areas of issues that you spoke about with both of the candidates. What I found really interesting and I wanted to ask about is the way I read it, five of those issues, the social issues, women's issues, education, environment, I forget what the fifth was, were all in Schauer's favor.
It was three and three.
It was actually three and three.
Oh, so that's not how I read it, and the one that seemed to trump the other five was the economy. Now, I get that the economy really matters, and I actually agree with you substantively. I hate to say this publicly, but I think Snyder has done some things that were smart and wise in terms of governing around the economy. So I give him credit for that. But I still see that whole totality as really, in the end, to me it seemed, from your words, weighing in Schauer's favor. And so I just wondered about, as you talked about here, waiting and considering, you know, the weights of these different issues, how then you end up with that endorsement.
And I would say that it's completely possible for reasonable, intelligent people to look at the same set of facts and have different opinions. And if you read these six pieces in the endorsement, or seven pieces in total, and your takeaway was that you wanted to support Mark Schauer, then I think that's your reading on it. And
you could certainly look at that endorsement and say, you know what, I place more weight on this particular aspect of it than the free press.
And that's something anyone who reads the endorsement is free to do. You're welcome to look at it and take away what you see or what you value from it. I mean, we can't tell you how to read what we write.
So the other thing is, I would say that for me... again, that burden that I wanted Mark to meet was very important. Detroit, you know, whatever you think about emergency managers, whatever you think about bankruptcy, you cannot deny the fundamental change that represents. Mark's answers on Detroit were, to be honest, unacceptable. He had not thought it through. All he wanted to say was, I'm against emergency managers. Well, that's cool. Fine, tell me what else you want to do. He couldn't do it. And then the third piece is, for me, the economy. I mean, I think we have deep disagreements with the governor about small pieces of his tax reform. But, you know, Mark's biggest thing is he wants to repeal the pension tax. Why does he want to repeal the pension tax? He can't tell me beyond, well, seniors shouldn't pay. But, of course, seniors who have 401ks, it's okay to tax them. He hadn't really thought that through in a way that made me think that he understands tax policy the way I need a governor to. And so, for me, those were huge negatives in his category.
Okay, we're gonna move to another question now.
I'm glad Stephen took it there. We're in Detroit, and we hadn't really talked about Detroit yet. And so I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm not persuaded and convinced to vote for Schauer. And I'll present it.
You're going to boo him too?
and I will say this.
No, because he wasn't drunk the night of the endorsement.
Yeah, he right. wasn't overserved. Right.
And I will say this as a Detroiter, that is how... I'm a man also, those other issues matter, but not as much for me as a person who grew up here, who has returned here, and who wants to stay here. The changes that have happened over the 4 years for the city of Detroit since Snyder has been governor versus when, and I love Jennifer Granholm, but where is she now? In California, not here, but... When she was in power for 8 years, what happened to Detroit? Kwame Kilpatrick, all of those things that I think there are critiques that can be made about the ability of Governor Snyder to govern in the sense that he could not get our roads fixed. But he was able to get outstate legislators, people who generally don't care, don't have to care about Detroit, to vote for legislation that has stabilized Detroit for my generation and generations to come. So, as you said, Stephen, they're just talking points. Emergency management is bad. Those are Democratic talking points, but I'm more sophisticated than that. I'm a Democrat, but I'm more sophisticated.
So,
can I jump in on this, though? Can I ask a question? Just one?
Yes. David Zeman.
Welcome back to John Bevo.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Zeman is here.
I'm not allowed to talk until John returns. I read all 17,000 words of the editorial.
I believe there were 24,000.
Even as someone who worked there, I don't know who is in the room, how is the decision made, how many voices are present, what voices count more than other voices, and so forth.
Well, there's a dartboard involved. So
2 men enter, 1 man leaves. No? Thunderdome? No one?
Where's Dan Austin? So
he's still not talking to Stephen.
So as the editorial page editor...
You'd be wrong.
Really?
Manage a staff of writers and editors and a cartoonist. Those are the principal members of the editorial board. But also Paul Anger, who's the editor of the paper, my boss, and our publisher, is also a member of the editorial board. And Joyce Genereau, who is the CEO of the entire Detroit Media Partnership, has essentially assumed the role she's actually assumed the role of publisher in the last couple of months and also had some say about this. There are voices in the room that matter more than others. Mine, as far as I'm concerned, matters an awful lot because I'm the person who has to go out and be booed in places down the block from my house. I have to defend this stuff in a way that the other members of the board don't. I also wrote this endorsement, except for the top, which my colleague to my left was super instrumental in doing herself, but I wrote through it. It is not a democracy. Newspapers are not democratic in the sense that we vote and then we decide. There is a decision that has to be made based on the institution and protecting the institution's values and history. You know, people misunderstand our history a lot. I think people think, well, we're the liberal newspaper. And that's true. We're the more liberal newspaper in this town. But, you know, you go back, I worked first as an intern for Joe Stroud, who was the editorial page editor for 30 years at the Free Press. He endorsed Engler two of the three times that he ran for governor. And so I'm very and I watched that, and I heard him talk that through. So I'm very mindful of what he was thinking when he did that. You know, one of the first people to hire me at the Free Press was Neil Schein. I've sat and listened to Neil Schein talk about Detroit and Michigan ad nauseum. I mean, these are the things that all go through my mind when I'm deciding what we need to do and why it's the right choice.
So. Okay, so I hate to be the party pooper, but we have about 5 minutes left, and we've got a couple more questions.
can I make one point about what he said, though?
Now that I've doused John's notes in beer, it's all right.
But I do think this is kind of important. Just remember that governors govern in their times, and you talked about John Engler, Jennifer Granholm, and then Rick Snyder. And remember, John Engler, you know, was governor during most of his governorship, which was also the Clinton presidency, during a time when our legislature was able to cut spending cut taxes and increase spending at the same time. That's never happened. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Jennifer Granholm was governor during a period when the economy tanked so badly that just even economists were boggled at how you could not overestimate how quickly things were heading south. And now we seem to be sort of back into a period where we're balancing things that you don't get to, you know, cut taxes and raise spending at the same time. You're not doing emergency management. You're prioritizing based on the resources that you have, not, you know, on what's absolutely evaporating. And each of those requires a different sort of leadership. Or am I wrong?
I think that's a great point about Engler and Granholm. If their terms had been reversed, we might have really been blown away. I mean, I think that would have been really fun if Jennifer Granholm had been governor in a time of economic expansion, and if Engler had been the budget cutter during a time of distress. Well, I think that would have been fascinating. Well, I don't know why we have to stop in 5 more minutes. We don't have anywhere to go. And also,
I thought you were giving me grump face.
Yeah,
well,
and
we
plus...
were, we were, you know, we're doing plus, the French time.
Aren't you sick of us talking? What,
well, we've
come
got
on,
some
mix
questions.
It up. Mix it up, all of you.
Was that
questions.
Nancy? Was that Nancy? Yeah,
question. No,
everybody's question.
Rick Pluta, I know you don't get in front of a microphone very often, so I understand. But Stephen Henderson, I don't think you gave a precise answer to the very specific question, who was in the room? And whose opinion counts?
Who was in the room?
Yeah, you mentioned some people.
I mean, you want names?
It was kind of vague.
It was
vague,
well,
Steve.
All right, Nancy. All right, so my staff includes Nancy Caffer, Brian Dickerson, Jewel Gompwani, Dan Austin, who's our copy editor and social media editor, Mike Thompson, who's our cartoonist. Am I missing anybody?
Not use these names to, like...
Yeah, well, you can have some of mine, right? The other people would include Paul and Joyce. There's no mystery or conspiracy afoot.
This is
how we make every decision, every big decision.
But the Koch brothers were there too. I thought
the Koch brothers were,
that?
You know,
they were there.
The DeVos.
I read it online.
They were features.
And also, I will say this is a very standard formulation for an editorial board. This is not.
It's actually not standard.
I mean, it's not?
I've worked. I was. I was. Well.
It's a really weird way to formulate an editorial board.
We've never seen anything like this before.
So this is the fourth editorial board I've been a part of.
Okay, I've worked at Little
of,
Papers, and it's like this. He's worked at Big Papers, maybe.
In Baltimore, where I was deputy editorial page editor, there were far more people in the room, and the publisher's opinion mattered more than everybody's. I mean, they ram stuff down our throats there. Same thing in Lexington, Kentucky, where I was on the editorial board for a time. Every paper handles it differently, and I'm totally comfortable with the way it gets handled here. If I had been uncomfortable with the decision we had made, I'm confident that would have carried the day. No one was going to force me to do something that I didn't want to do.
You just try it, guys.
Well, yeah. Right. I mean, I think I was less committed to the decision we made than our publisher was. I was less troubled by our decision than some people on my staff were. It really is my call. At the end of the day, no one's really going to tell me I've got to do something that I'm not wanting to do. So if you want to blame somebody, it belongs here.
We've got some other questions in the back.
Or blame Jewel, either one.
Oh, no, Steve, let's not ever blame Jewel. No.
Not that this would pertain directly to the editorial, but just, you know, let's say Mark Schauer wins, you still have a Republican-led legislature. So I don't know if any of you just want to talk about what the next 4 years would be. If Mark Schauer wins, I mean, is it a stalemate?
If Mark Schauer wins, I seriously doubt that you will have a Republican-led legislature, at least in the House.
It's really hard to believe that if the Get Out the Vote efforts are actually able to get Mark Schauer to become the next governor, that the House won't be able to pick up the 6 seats that are needed. That's just because right now, if we're thinking, what, 3 or 4, you know, maybe 2, absolutely, the idea that a Schauer would be able to win without the House, it'd be surprising. I mean, it could absolutely happen. It'd be surprising, though.
And once again, Lon feels like his worst nightmares and fondest dreams are being voiced by the panel.
Yeah, Vaughn, just
so again, why can't we ask him to say a word about what he's doing differently from his predecessors? He's
Vaughn,
used to talking. He's
to
a big boy. He showed
he's
up
a guest.
Here.
He's a guest.
Not everyone runs in that in Lansing Press Corps.
He's a guest.
Even the MDP chairman gets a night off.
Well, he's a guest, but he's not a special guest if he
he's
doesn't
talk
to
us. He's a special guest. He's my special guest.
Vaughn, yeah.
Was he in the editorial board meeting?
No comment.
No, Karl Rove took his place.
Can we talk briefly about the Senate or the House races that aren't?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that microphone really has mattered in this room.
May I mention that I'm devilishly handsome? Now that I know you're recording this, that's why I said I'm devilishly handsome.
Okay, so the gentleman in the back who looks like Fabio, your question.
Hey, Dodarian, is it tough to be in another bar? Is this just hard?
Not after a couple of drinks.
This evening has gone off
the anchor bar, everyone. The anchor bar.
Could we talk, Could we talk briefly about the House races that are in flux? You know, you said
the state
six,
House races.
State House races. Because for my money, that's something that's much more important and has a lot more impact on the way things are going to go in the next 4 years.
Lansing Bureau Chief, would you like to take that question?
No.
Okay.
You want to talk about them? I guess the problem is there isn't a directed question there. That clearly, again, you know that this is a turnout election. This is a GOTV election. It doesn't seem to be turning on specific issues. It is whether or not, you know, one side or the other does a better job of getting their voters out. Republicans in a midterm, especially in the midterm of a Democratic president's second term, would have a natural advantage. That said, that Oakland County seems to be, you know, really the battleground. And in some respects, it almost seems to have shifted from Macomb County. There are, you know, some, you know, at least a couple of state house races. Although I would turn you to Kathy Gray, who just has done a couple of great articles on it. about that. But it's what is it? It's all about the bass.
It's all about the bass. The bass. Yeah, that's become sort of Rick and our theme song for It's Just Politics, because that is really literally what it's all going to be.
You know, whether or not Democrats can get get their voters out.
Mm-hmm.
So you're Royal Oak?
Madison Heights.
Okay.
If you have time to only watch one race, the one I'm going to watch is the Canton Senate race, where Patrick Colbeck as far as they get Tea Party against Diane Slavens, which is a
it's a wonderful race.
That is probably the funnest legislative race. And I am not convinced that when the contributions come out after the election
that
is
Randy
over,
Richardville didn't
that
write
Randy
some
Richardville
checks
didn't
to,
write some checks that some other write, that
and he didn't write them to Colbeck.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, any
that's
other?
That's a race that some Republicans are willing to lose.
Yeah, did you have a question? Great.
Hi. I'm wondering what you could point to that Governor Snyder has done to retain young people here in Michigan, to attract young people to Michigan, because considering that Governor Snyder has a very poor record on job creation, I think he's tied for third from last in the nation.
He has a mixed record on job creation.
He has a very poor record on women's issues. He signed into law HB 5711.
He vetoed the bill.
He vetoed the rape insurance.
But he signed some requirements making abortion clinics register as ambulatory surgical centers.
So the question is what the governor's done to retain talent here in Michigan.
He's very poor on LGBT issues.
The rationale for the ending the pension exemption was that that was being carried by younger families. That was specifically directed towards that.
And you see how the younger families have come flooding back to Michigan since then. It's been incredible. We don't know what to do with them.
The disincentives to young people have
honestly,
to do with things.
They're not doing it because of the pension exemption or otherwise. I mean, we know
that. The disincentives to things. The primary disincentive to young people in the state is the city of Detroit. Okay, that's the place that you would see young people making a choice to come here from other places. And, again, quibble with the methods. I would not have done things the way the governor did them. But the move to reset the table here financially and to wipe out 60 years of decline and say, this is the bottom, we're going to try to go in a different direction from here, I think you can't give him enough credit for that. No Democrat has ever proposed anything remotely like that. And I'm a, I'll say this, I'm a Democrat, okay? Like, that's not on the table. I think you have to be, I have deep disagreements with the governor on a lot of things, but Detroit is where he's made his mark, and if you talk about attracting young people to this state, you are going to have to do it. They are not going to move to the Thumb, or they're not going to move to
Actually,
Alpena.
They're moving to Grand Rapids. They're moving to Traverse City.
They go to Grand Rapids,
to
right, and look at Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is a great example of a place where regional cooperation is off the charts in Grand Rapids.
Charming
they have a
downtown.
Balanced budget. They have a charming downtown. I mean, all the things that the governor is trying to create here, you see in Grand Rapids and spades.
I would say, on the topic of Detroit, I've been covering the city of Detroit since 2005. And in 2005, Detroit met the criteria for emergency management in PA 72, which is the state's emergency manager law at the time. The question was not that Detroit did not hit those triggers. It did. There was no political will to do something about it. So we've kind of touched on the subject before. What if Detroit had started this process in 2005? We would now be 9 years into recovery. Where would we be today? But there was not political... And I understand the concept of doing an emergency manager should be something that is a last resort. Everything should be tried first. It's a very serious prospect. But there was no question. In 2005 was the year that the pension certificates were sold, $1.4 billion in debt that have proved horribly problematic in terms of the way they've played out. If you read our series, How Detroit Went Broke, you can see how just dramatically... Thank you. How dramatically Detroit's debt picture changes if we didn't sell those certificates of participation and do the credit swaps that went along with them. Detroit was languishing at that time financially, and yet I don't think anyone in this room, Governor Granholm didn't pull the trigger on doing anything about the city. And I think it is very hard because of the historic relationship between the Democratic Party and the labor unions, and labor union contract.
Well, also the Cormie Kilpatrick scandal made that very problematic.
It did, but the Kwame Kilpatrick scandal, and this is one of the key miscomprehensions about Detroit, the Kwame Kilpatrick issue exacerbated financial problems that had been
there during
Kilpatrick's mayorship.
But that was the distraction.
We got into a cycle of even more just really destructive borrowing. We had borrowing, short-term borrowing from
borrowing
next year's
to pay
revenues.
Borrowing.
The equivalent of taking out a credit card to pay your electricity bill. I mean, it was just disastrous borrowing that put us really even further into debt. But the conditions that led to that had been decades in the making. They were there in 2005. They were there in 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10. And we saw all this time go by during which the city's got less money to deal with its problems. Institutions in the city weakened further. Neighborhoods weakened further. Look on whydon'tweownthis.com or Loveland Technologies. They do this thing where they go around Detroit neighborhoods and they look at Google Street Views from 2009 to today. Look at what has happened to Detroit neighborhoods in 5 years. The deterioration that has happened, the blight has happened, and if it doesn't make you angry that no one stepped in to try to reverse this course in that time, then I don't know what to say to you. So. Okay.
Hold on, you do not get to talk in the back without
you
a
had an opportunity to be up here and you lost it.
Do you want to talk about blamesmanship or do you want to talk about the real conditions on the ground? Because we can say whose fault it is and we can decide who we want to blame for it, but the fact is we have a reality that we have to deal with.
Now it's getting fun.
It's a throwdown. Actually, Stephen, hand her
the
microphone.
All I'm saying is there were a lot of moving parts. And you know, it wasn't all one person, and it wasn't all Jennifer Granholm or Kwame Kilpatrick. No. I mean, the financial atmosphere that allowed people to take out $75,000 second mortgages on houses that were worth maybe $20,000. I mean, that was completely outside of the realm of the city's control.
If you can find me a person who got a $75,000 mortgage on a $20,000 house in Detroit after 2005, I will give you $20. Like, I mean, this was there are a lot of moving pieces. There are a lot of balls in the air. You can't point the finger at one person, but the writing was on the wall.
Stephen, up here, quick question.
I can yell it loud enough. Detroit is a union city. What did Snyder do for the unions? What did Snyder do for income?
Nothing.
He did nothing for the unions.
This is a great question.
Minimum wage.
A great question. He didn't do anything for the unions, and Michigan is no longer. Detroit may be a union city, but 16% of the workers in Michigan are union members. And this is the conundrum for the Democratic Party. The unions remain, big labor remains a big, huge piece of the finances for the Democratic Party. But they have trouble connecting to voters across Michigan. There have been 4 ballot issues in the past 15 years that have been clearly, distinctly labor-run, pro-labor issues. And they've all gotten trounced at the ballot box. Again, the gift that keeps giving. Lon Johnson back here. This is his great conundrum in the Democratic Party. It's still a big labor party that's still a major source of finances if you look at the PACs and who gives what. But the math doesn't add up. 4 out of 5 voters in Michigan are not in unions. They have to
adjust to a different age.
I would also like to remind everyone that the people behind the drive to lift the residency requirement, which was a huge contributor to the decline of population in Detroit and the decline of a lot of the institutions that serve people, were unions. Police and fire unions did not want the residency requirement in place. This was a big push, and I mean, 1999, residency requirements lifted. We see population drop. We see the network of Catholic schools that serve kids of people who were required to live in Detroit start to close. I mean, this was a huge turning point, and you absolutely cannot ignore the role of the unions in pushing for that. Also, I haven't done the numbers since 2009, the 2009 election, but at that time there were like 12,000 city workers and like maybe 8,000 of them belonged to unions. So in terms, as John was saying, of a force that moves the needle in elections, it's not where it was. So.
But Snyder turns
his back
on
them.
Yeah,
he's a math guy. He's looking at the math.
Yeah. And a lot of economists have said that too. Okay, we're going to move on. Just because we have to wrap this up, tell me you don't want to keep drinking with these people.
Because we find ourselves fascinating.
Why do we have to wrap this up?
Well, we don't. We need to wrap up the official portion. No. We will all continue to enjoy our beverages.
We will hang out. But
Bob, you got to go home.
Yeah. Wait, oh, my God.
Bob Scon, who has a great CD, bobscon.com.
The great Bob Scon, who's our engineer. Yay, Bob. Who makes all of these sounds so great. By the way, we should say Steve Krupinski, who goes out and does the advanced work and makes all of these.
Apparently, Bob has to go home.
Can we have a round of applause for Steve Krupinski, too, please?
You got it.
He's the person who makes all of this happen.
Very true. We just show up and run our mouths.
You got it. Okay. Have we been on the radio all this time?
No. So, a question.
Michigan Radio is
we are getting close to the end of this election cycle. In the next one, we are not going to have a gubernatorial race. We will have a
presidential race.
What are we going to be talking about in what is really going to be a much more national election than the one that we're seeing right now?
We're doing a round robin?
And we're doing it a round robin, 30 seconds or less, starting with Stephen Henderson.
Go.
Immigration. Okay. Immigration, I think, will end up being a defining issue of the next election. Okay. And I think that's the reason that Republicans are sort of on the outs. They can't come to terms with it. With their base, and Democrats will get their act together over this.
And you think that's a national and local issue?
You said 30 seconds. Go, Nancy.
Okay, Nancy.
Women's rights. We've seen persistent efforts by the right wing to not only attack abortion but birth control by redefining common and popular methods of birth control as abortion, which is not supported by science. We have conflicted feelings as a nation about abortion. We are 100% all in on contraception. And if Republicans continue to push these issues, they're going to vastly alienate voters, and I hope to see a candidate who champions women's reproductive rights.
John Bebo.
I have no idea. The Center for Michigan focuses only on statewide issues, as does Bridge, which makes 2018.
What are we going to be talking about?
Which makes 2018 a fascinating year, and we got to get some sleep before then.
David Zeman.
We're not talking about 18. We're talking about 16.
I'm talking about 18. You're not going to make me talk about what I don't want.
Making me tired.
I would say the same numbers that John is talking about in Michigan in terms of union support and how the numbers don't support Democrats is the same argument to say the same thing that Steve said, that immigration is probably. The numbers just don't add up for Republicans, and they're not doing anything about it.
Okay. I think that's where we'll leave. Oh, do we do it, too? Oh. Okay, you got 30 seconds. What was the 2016? We will be talking about Hillary Clinton's 2-year-old granddaughter, Charlotte. Oh, don't tell me that is not what we are all going to be talking about, whether we want to
or
not.
On top of the car,
please.
Going down the road. Please.
I don't get me wrong. I love the idea we're going to be talking about policy. Don't tell me we're not going to see this photo spread of Hillary with Charlotte.
The
in
dog
October
on the car was Mitt Romney.
Right.
FYI.
No, but you wait. You're going to see that granddaughter on top of that car.
Whatevs.
Okay, Rick Pluta, you're going to end it. You got 30 seconds.
Lon Johnson is going to be going, how can I build these lists?
Okay. Everyone, thank you so much for turning out.
Thank
tonight.
You so much.
What a fun evening. Thank you again to the Detroit Beer Company for housing this chaos and these shenanigans. And thank you to Bob Scon and Steve Krupinski and all of our panelists.
Next week's
Right, and again, remember, a week from tonight in Ann Arbor at the Circus Bar, 25-cent PAP still? Do they still do that? So how could you not do that with Cindy Canty talking about election results? So be there. Okay, thank you everyone so much for coming out. Drive home safe.